Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Best-selling true crime master Harold Schechter explores the real-life headline-making psychos, serial murders, thrill-hungry couples, and lady killers who inspired a century of classic films. The necktie murders in Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy, Chicago Jazz Age Crime of Passion, the fatal hookup in Looking for Mr. Goodbar, the high school horrors committed by the costume slasher in Scream. These and other cinematic crimes have become part of pop culture history, and each found inspiration in true events that provided the raw material for our greatest blockbusters, indie art films, black comedies, Hollywood classics, and grindhouse horrors. So what's the reality behind Psycho, Badlands, The Hills Have Eyes, A Place in the Sun, Arsenic and Old Lace, and Dirty Harry? How did such tabloid-ready killers as Bonnie and Clyde, body snatchers Burke and Hare, Texas sniper Charles Whitman Jr., Nurse Slayer Richard Speck, and Leopold and Loeb exert their power on the public imagination and become the stuff of movie lore? In this collection of revelatory essays, true crime historian Harold Schechter takes a fascinating trip down the crossroads of fact and fiction to reveal the sensational real-life stories that are more shocking, taboo, and fantastic than even the most imaginative screenwriter can dream up. The book that we're featuring this evening is Ripped from the Headlines, the shocking true stories behind the movie's most memorable crimes, with my special guest, journalist and author and historian, Harold Schechter. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Harold Schechter.
Well, thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Again, congratulations on this book. Incredible, ripped from the headlines.
Yeah, very proud of it. Hard book to write in many ways. Required double the amount of research in a way that I usually do. So.
Yes.
Had to research the movies and the crimes based on it. I mean, the premise of the book is that nowadays, or at least up until relatively recently when you could go to a movie, you would go to a movie and very commonly see a title card at the beginning announcing that it was based on true events or based on a true story. That didn't happen so much in the old days. In fact, it was more common for there to be a disclaimer at the end of the movie saying that any resemblance to real people or real events was purely coincidental. But in fact, during Hollywood's golden age and before and after, screenwriters often turned to the newspapers and sensational crimes as the inspiration for their screenplays. And there are a lot of movies ranging from classic films like Anatomy of a Murder and Arsenic and Old Lace, to cult films like Toby Hooper's Eaten Alive and Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes, which viewers often don't realize were based on true events. So that's what my book does. My book looks at 40 movies and then recounts the actual crimes that inspired them.
Right. Now, before we talk about some of these famous movies and from often books that were bestsellers and then they were adapted into movies. And a lot of these movies, the real-life criminal source, crime source, spawns more than one movie. So just briefly, yes. Tell us a couple of the directors that you were especially covering in this book, just because of some of the numbers of movies that they made concerning or at least were inspired by real crimes, but also that you thought had done some very memorable movies regarding these true life crimes.
Well, I mean, Hitchcock appears, I think, three times, let's see, maybe four times in the book. Psycho, of course, and maybe we can talk a little bit about how I first got into the subject, which was through Psycho, then Rope, then Frenzy, and then Shadow of a Doubt. All four of those films were inspired by true cases. Fritz Lang has a couple of movies in there. One, M, the great classic M, which made Peter Lorre into an international movie star, and a movie called Fury. Actually, I think Fritz Lang has three movies. There's also You Only Live Once, which was a Fritz Lang production. Might even be a fourth, I'm not sure, or a third. But, you know, there are a lot of great directors in there. Otto Preminger, for example, the director of Anatomy of a Murder. George Stevens, the great American director, who directed one of my all-time favorite movies, The Western Chain, is in there with A Place in the Sun. So, again, you know, it ranges from classic movies directed by great auteur directors to some less great movies.
yeah.
Although, you know, the ones that I cover that are, you know, less highly regarded possibly by serious highbrow cineasts, you know, are still directed by excellent directors. I mean, you know, Wes Craven has two movies in there, The Hills Have Eyes and Scream. Toby Hooper, yeah, I'm not sure what happened to Toby Hooper. You know, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I regard, as many people do, as this great masterpiece of horror. And then his follow-up and pretty much all his subsequent movies were kind of disappointing. So anyway, so there's a range of directors in there.
So as you alluded to, tell us about Psycho and how this project, the genesis of this project and its relation to Psycho and that story and movie.
Well, I mean, it was through Psycho and Texas Chainsaw Massacre that I first got into the whole true crime game. I, up until that time, had been writing books about whatever subject caught my interest at the time. And I was writing a book called Film Tricks. It's going back to the late 1980s, which was a history of cinematic special effects going back to Georges Méliès. This was before the whole CGI revolution. When I was working on the chapter on horror effects, I came across what was then the relatively little-known fact. It was unknown to me that both Psycho and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I regarded and probably still regard as the two greatest horror movies ever made, had both been inspired by a real-life case out of Ed Gein, the Midwestern Wisconsin necrophile. And you know, that was very fascinating to me. So I began to research that case, and that became the first of my true crime books, Deviant. At that time, when I published Deviant, Silence of the Lambs hadn't yet come out. And, of course, Silence of the Lambs also drew on the Gein case and the figure of Buffalo Bill. So in a way, you know, that was my first awareness of this. I was also, until my recent retirement after 42 years, I was, wow. as I think you may know, a teacher of America, a professor of American literature at Queens
right.
College. And I was aware that certain classics of American literature, very notably, for example, Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy, have been based on real crimes. So, you know, that fed into this too, especially since the Dreiser movie then became made into that great, the great George Stevens movie, A Place in the Sun. So all those mm-hmm. things, you know, the topic of how real crimes get transformed into different forms of literature and popular entertainment, you know, has been with me for a while. So.
Right. Let's give the audience an example of this, the movie mm-hmm. and then the inspiration with Anatomy of a Murder by director Otto Preminger, James Stewart, starring mm-hmm. Lee Remick, Ben Gazzara.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about this lawyer, John D. Volker, because this is mm-hmm. the pivotal person in this entire story, both movie
right.
and real life.
Yeah. Well, Volker had been a lawyer in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And, you know, he had been writing some books and then got the inspiration to write a fictionalized version of a what was locally a very notorious murder case where he had been the defense attorney.
Right.
And the book Anatomy of a Murder became a big bestseller and then was transformed into this very powerful and in many ways for the time kind of radical movie because it challenged a lot of the censorship restrictions of what was called the Hays Code at that time. Actually, it's an interesting example of what I kind of alluded to earlier, because Volker claimed that that his novel was a work of pure fiction,
right?
But it followed the details of the true life case so closely that when the movie came out, both he and Otto Preminger got sued by the widow of the victim mm-hmm. in the case. For the way the movie portrayed the character who was based on her husband. But essentially, both the film and the real-life case had to do with a tavern keeper who was, it had to do with an army lieutenant who shoots and kills a tavern keeper because the husband believes or has been told by his wife that she was raped by the tavern keeper, that the tavern keeper had offered her a ride home. She had been in the tavern by herself. He'd offered her a ride home, and he had brutally raped her. And the husband, after making her, this is, again, both in real life and in the book and the film, which follow the case very closely, the husband, after making her swear in a Bible that that's what happened, took his service revolver, went to the bar, and just shot this tavern keeper down. And he believed that he would be exonerated based on what is commonly called the unwritten law, which was supposedly a husband is entitled to shoot the man who is his wife.
Right.
He was promptly informed that there was actually no such thing legally as an unwritten law. And it became, again, a very, very sensational murder trial in which Volker got a lieutenant acquitted on the basis of what was called irresistible impulse.
Right.
And that's what, you know, that's what happens in the movies. I mean, the movie, you know, adds at the end a very surprise kind of Perry Mason-like sudden revelation.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's a terrific movie, as you say, starring Jimmy Stewart as the defense attorney, and was the debut film of both Ben Gazzara as the husband and George C. Scott, who plays the rather oily prosecuting attorney who is Jimmy Stewart's opponent, courtroom opponent, and Lee Remick at her most beautiful as the wife. So, and as I said, I mean, one of the interesting things, it's kind of a landmark film because, you know, the Hays Code had held sway over Hollywood for decades. You know, filmmakers weren't even allowed to use the word pregnant. The movie was considered to be very, very, very sexually frank at the time. In fact, so much so that supposedly, and from what I've read, it was actually true, James Stewart's father took out advertisements in his local papers urging his neighbors not to see the film because it was indecent. So, anyway, any incredible of your listeners who have not seen it, I highly recommend it. It's one of the great courtroom dramas of Hollywood.
Yeah, and you write, too, that the actual locations were filmed. The tavern and Volker's home and law office and the courthouse where the trial was conducted.
Yeah. Preminger insisted on absolute authenticity. So, yes, he went to the town in Michigan's Upper Peninsula and shot it all on location where these events really happened. And the other interesting point about the movie is that the presiding judge, Joseph Welch, has become this kind of legendary in the annals of American jurisprudence, and because he was the man who, during the infamous Army McCarthy hearings in the 1950s, you know, finally confronted McCarthy, you know, said very famously, "At long last, sir, have you no decency?" Which many people regard as the beginning of McCarthy's downfall. So,
yeah, it's an important historic movie, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about one that it's surprising that it would have, I think at face value, would be surprising that it would have a connection to a real-life murder horror, but Arsenic and Old Lace, director Frank Capra's classic, starring Cary Grant, Peter Lorre, Priscilla Lane, Raymond Massey. This is about a serial killer preying on strangers.
Normally
talk about serial killers preying on strangers, but this is not about serial killers preying on strangers, but it's about poisoners.
Well, Arsenic and Old Lace, you know, is considered one of the, you know, classic comedies of that era. And it's basically about these sort of dotty old maiden aunts of Cary Grant who run a kind of boarding house and take an elderly, you know, elderly men and, you know, who are not in the best of health. And then at some point treat them to some poisoned elderberry wine and give them Christian burials in the basement of the house. And, you know, it's largely, I think, because of Arsenic and Lace that this image of female serial poisoners as, or the image of that kind of poison murder, you know, is taken on this kind of aura of some quaint, old-fashioned Victorian way of disposing of people. But it was based on the case of a real-life female serial poisoner named Amy Archer Gilligan, who opened an old age home in Windsor, Connecticut, and, you know, began bumping off her victims. You know, she would collect fees from the family members. I think the charge was around a flat fee of around $30,000, which was, you know, quite a bit of money at that time. I think the flat fee was about $1,000, which was equivalent to $30,000 today. And then instead of caring for them as promised, she would just poison them and, you know, dispose of the bodies or claim that they had died, you know, of natural causes. You know, she would take their possessions and whatever money they had and so on. But Amy Archer Gilligan was I became very interested in the phenomenon of female serial murder a number of years ago when I was researching and writing a book called Fatal about a very prolific female serial killer named Jane Toppin, who confessed to 31 murders at the turn of the 20th century.
Right.
And she was regarded, she was listed at one point in Guinness Book of World Records as America's most prolific serial killer until she was supplanted by John Wayne Gacy. And in researching and writing that book, I you know, up until then, the standard line was that Aileen Wuornos had been America's first serial killer.
Right.
But, you know, but I became aware that there had been a great many of these female serial poisoners who had killed way more people than Aileen Wuornos did. And also, I came to realize that the way these female serial killers murder their victims was in a way far more sadistic than, let's say, what Aileen Wuornos did, you know, because Aileen Wuornos gunned these guys down, whereas Jane Toppin and other people, you know, would subject their victims to these agonizing deaths and sometimes very prolonged agonizing deaths, because they wouldn't just kill them, you know, swiftly. They would make them sick and sicker and until they died. So I'd become aware of Amy Archer Gilligan as one of America's premier female serial killers at that point. And it was while doing my research on that subject that I became aware of her connection to the Frank Capra movie, at which I have to say is, you know, again, the only case in the book in which a real-life sensational murder case got transformed into a beloved comedy.
Interesting, too, that when I look, and I think other true crime fans will have this as well, they're quite familiar with some of the famous killers in this book and serial killers in this book, but not so much the connection to movies that we've heard of but maybe not have seen,
mm-hmm.
especially because
mm-hmm.
we didn't know there was a connection. You talk about mm-hmm. Badlands. What is the inspiration for the movie with Badlands, starring Martin
mm-hmm.
Sheen, Sissy Spacek?
Mm-hmm.
Who were the inspiration
yeah.
for the movie Badlands?
It was one of the very sensational murder cases of the 1950s. Concerned a young man named Charlie Starkweather, who is a kind of James Dean wannabe and a total sociopath, and his underage 14-year-old girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, who went on this killing spree in the Badlands of Nebraska. You know, and it was a huge case. I mean, it was, you know, made nationwide headlines. And, you know, Starkweather and Fugate have kind of achieved, I would say, you know, among crime aficionados, something of the legendary status of some of the, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, for example. You know,
right.
they were this... you know, and you know, they've been the basis of a number of movies I mentioned in the book. I mean, the Terrence Malick film Badlands, which is one of the most stunning cinematic debuts in the history of movies, you know, is a real masterpiece. I mean, it stars Charlie Sheen as Starkweather and Sissy Spacek as Fugate. I mean, they have you know, they have other names in the film, but it's
yes.
very closely based on them and follows their crime spree very closely. There's another film, a low-budget shocker, called The Sadist, which is also based on the Starkweather-Fugate spree. And that movie, although it doesn't match Malick's film, is a work of cinematic art. It, in a way, captures the sociopathic nature of Charlie Starkweather more than Malick's film does. You know, Malick's film is so beautiful and so aestheticized, it little dulls the horror of some of what they did. But the sadists, anyway, yes, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. You talk about movies that Dillinger and the crimes of John Dillinger and his infamy inspired, like High Sierra. Tell us about a couple movies that the crimes of John Dillinger inspired.
Oh, well, there have been a number. High Sierra, with Humphrey Bogart, who plays a Dillinger-like character. There are some films like Badlands or Compulsion, let's say, or Anatomy of a Murder, that are inspired by true crimes that follow the cases very, very closely. Then there are other films like High Sierra, Scream, and one or two others that were inspired by these real crimes, but really are very use them as a springboard. To tell a fictionalized story. And that's the case with High Sierra. I mean, it uses Dillinger, public enemy number one, one of the, legendary gangsters of that period, as a springboard for this film. But there have been a number of biopics made about Dillinger. There was a 1945 movie called Dillinger with Lawrence Tierney, who I was just rewatching Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. Tierney
right.
plays, the guy who is in charge of the whole thing. Then there was a 1972 movie, Dillinger, which was the directorial debut of John Milius. It's very known for these two-fisted, red-blooded movies, like Conan the Barbarian and Red Dawn, and who also wrote the screenplay for Apocalypse Now and the Dirty Harry sequel, Magnum Force. In that one, Warren Oates, the late, great Warren Oates, plays Dillinger. So recommend that. And then there was a John Sayles scripted movie called The Lady in Red, and Roger Corman did one in 1995, Dillinger Capone. Most recently, Michael Mann's Public Enemies with Johnny Depp as Dillinger. So, there have been a number of these films that have, advertised themselves as essentially nonfiction depictions of Dillinger. But, what interests me most, as I was saying in the book, were films that, comes as a surprise to many people that they were based on real criminals.
Yeah, absolutely. One example of that is The Hills Have Eyes, which is a horror flick from 1977, directed and written by Wes Craven. And this is 3 years after what you call the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a masterpiece, a horror masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
The Hills Have Eyes. The small group of cannibalistic psychos.
yes.
How can it be possibly related to a true crime, and what true crime was this related to?
Well, this is a little tricky. Because a lot of questions have been raised about the historical truth of the crime that it was, of the case that it was inspired by. People even now are not entirely sure if it was fact or legend, but Craven was inspired by tales of a supposedly real historical cannibal clan that lived and operated in Scotland. Let's see. trying to get the exact date. Sometime, I believe, in the 16th century, maybe the 17th century, anyway,
right.
Quite a long time ago, the leader of which was named Sawney Bean. And supposedly this was an outlaw family who resided in the wilds of Scotland and, were incestuous and cannibalistic. And they were, I guess it was towards the latter half of the 16th century. They lived in a cave and they would prey on unwary travelers whom they would rob and murder and dismember and consume. They were finally captured and brought to justice, by a small army led by the King of Scotland himself. That story has been long reported, again, going back to the 1700s, as historically factual. Again, recent scholarship has raised serious doubts as to whether Sawney Bean and his cannibal clan really existed. But in any case, that was the story that inspired The Hills Have Eyes, which is, a very grueling horror film about this all-American family on a road trip that takes a shortcut. Always a bad idea in a horror movie. And their vehicles break down, their trailer, I guess, breaks down in the desert, and they become set upon by this very, very creepy feral family of cannibals. So, I think, I guess it was remade, wasn't it? I think, yes, it was definitely remade.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. What's his name? The French guy whose name escapes me right now, but yeah.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity, Harold, just to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. It's time to customize your FabFitFun box for the summer season. My wife Lisa was excited, of course, to receive her FabFit summer box and everything she found inside. She especially liked the insulated picnic bag from Business and Pleasure and the reed diffuser from Solstice and from Myriad, the Environmental Shield Energizing Cleansing Cream. Lisa's always excited to get her new FabFitFun box. Every box is curated specifically to each person because you select what goes into your box each season. It's the perfect way to treat yourself or someone else. Get the products you really want when you customize your box online, with most of the items customizable. The boxes sell out fast, so sign up for yours today. Also, connect with women throughout the world in FabFitFun's community forum. Join a members-only club for cooking or books or meet new friends to swap products with. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. Sign up today to receive your first box and join a community of over 1 million women who are already obsessed. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at FabFitFun.com. It retails for $49.99 but always has a value over $200. That's $10 off when you use code MURDER at FabFitFun.com. Now, we talked about a movie that, again, that was, as you say, historians have said that the Sawney Bean legend may just be just that and not so factual, and then The Hills Have Eyes have very little, I guess, connection to that actual story. But you include a story which I found was very, very interesting called The Hitchhiker from 1953 with a woman named Ida Lupino. And you say the only classic film noir directed by a woman. And this book, this film closely based on a real-life serial killer. But it's interesting the research that she did into the case herself. Can you tell us a little bit about how far she went into this actual research for The Hitchhiker?
By the way, just to clarify an earlier remark you made, even though the Sony Bean case, again, may not be factual, it was still, you know, the direct inspiration. The story itself was the direct inspiration for The Hills Have Eyes.
Right.
Just, you know. So The Hitchhiker, so Ida Lupino, you know, very, very important figure in Hollywood. You know, there in our own time, there's been a lot of renewed interest in female directors, of which there were not many in Hollywood. Ida Lupino, who is also a very well-known actress in her own life, you know, is one of the most prominent female directors. And so the case that the movie The Hitchhiker is based on is a guy named, a young psycho named Billy Cook, who abducted a couple of guys who are on a, you know, on a fishing expedition, and you know, took them on this sort of nightmarish odyssey, and, you know, committed these various murders along the way, and you know, is finally captured. In researching her movie, Lupino actually visited him when he was in prison. I mean, he was ultimately convicted of kidnap murders of five members of a single family, and ultimately he was executed in 1952. But Lupino went so far as to go interview him when he was in prison, to get, you know, in trying to make her film as authentic as possible. So anyway, it's a film that I was actually not fully aware of until I began researching my book. And it's definitely, you know, I definitely recommend it to your viewers. I mean, the guy who plays the psycho was actually the actor. I don't know if I know there's a new Perry Mason miniseries on HBO. I don't know how many of your listeners recall the great classic Perry Mason series,
right,
starring Raymond Burr, who, by the way, also played a great psycho in Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. But the psycho in this movie, The Hitchhiker, is played by the actor Hamilton Berger, who was Raymond Burr's opponent, you know, perennially
right,
losing opponent in all the Perry Mason series. So,
now you talk about M being a classic, 1931. Written by director Fritz Lang, and you, as you write, and as you said, that it made Peter Lorre a star. You said it was possible for Fritz Lang to induce a profound sense of horror in an audience without showing a single image of explicit violence or gore. I thought you were talking about Alfred Hitchcock for a second, but so tell us what. A little bit about the movie and why it is considered classic before we talk about the crimes and murders that inspired it.
You know, it's again, justifiably regarded as one of the great masterpieces of cinema. It's a German movie. Lorre, again, became a big star, and he was, you know, imported to Hollywood, where obviously he turned in some great classic performances. And the movie is about a pedophiliac serial killer named Beckert, you know, who preys on young children, girls, and his crimes create such public outrage, you know, that the police, you know, begin to stage all these raids on every criminal hangout, and they're basically putting all the criminals in Berlin out of business. So the criminals themselves decide, you know, they got to get the police off their backs and find this guy. So he is, Beckert is hunted down and ultimately captured by all the, you know, criminals, and put on a kind of kangaroo trial, right. You know, which Laurie does this amazing turn in which, you know, he gives this very, very famous speech, you know, where he says, "You don't know what it's like to be me." I mean, even though his crimes are unspeakable, yeah. He manages to generate, you know, a certain amount of sympathy,
right.
Because you see that he's in the grip of this incredible compulsion. But in the beginning of the film, you know, you see, you know, this mother who's in her apartment, and all the mothers are waiting for their kids to come home from school, and you see a little girl on her way home from school, and this pudgy, creepy-looking man, you know, Peter Lorre stops her on the street and buys her a balloon and you know, takes her for ice cream, and, you know, meanwhile the mother, you know, that's intercut with the mother becoming increasingly worried and frantic because her little girl hasn't arrived home yet, you know, and then there's this cut to, you know, the balloon, you know, being caught in some electric wires, or telephone wires, you know, you see the little girl, her name is Elsie, he's bought her a rubber ball, and you see the ball rolling out of some shrubbery. You know, it's clear he's brought her behind the shrubbery to do something awful to her. And then you see her balloon tangled up in these telephone wires. You know, the whole impact is shattering, you know, because again, you know, often, as the greatest, you know, filmmakers often know, you know, leaving something to the viewer's imagination, you know, can cause, you know, it can have a more unsettling effect, you know, than showing some graphic violence. So yeah, I mean, it's an amazing film, and it was based on or inspired by the crimes of one of the most notorious, we call them now serial killers. Back then they called them lust murderers in 20th century history, a guy named Peter Curtin, who was an extreme sadist from youth. Partly he had been schooled in sadism by this depraved neighbor of his, you know, who taught him how to derive sexual pleasure from torturing animals and so on. And he preyed on men, women, children, animals. You know, he got off particularly on drinking their blood. He was known as the Vampire of Dusseldorf. He was actually one inspiration for one of America's most heinous serial killers, Albert Fish. Albert Fish,
right.
You know, cut out and saved articles about Curtin. One of the interesting things I found in researching the Curtin case was that the term serial murderer was first used in connection with the Curtin case in the 1930s. You know, for a long time, Robert Ressler of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit claimed credit for coining the phrase serial killer, you know, and then earlier instances were found in some British publications going back to the 1960s. But when I was researching the Curtin case, I found that the head of the Berlin Homicide Division used the term Syrian mörder, serial murderer to describe Curtin. So as far as I know, that's the earliest known use of the term. So.
And that's probably in the 30s, as you write, when
yes.
this case
mm-hmm.
occurred.
Yes.
Mm. Yep. Very interesting. Pravity of this vampire of Dusseldorf, though, you do talk about his childhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only the influence of the neighbor, but also the parents' life, and again, seeing
yeah.
his parents have sex and 13 kids in a one-room home, so
yeah.
horrendous upbringing,
yeah.
but... they were able to get information from Curtin himself, some kind of insight into the crimes
mm-hmm.
he did, which was
mm-hmm.
Unprecedented at the time, obviously, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he spoke very, very, very freely about his crimes. He also compared himself to Jack the Ripper.
Right.
Just a quote from the book, Curtin said, the main thing for me was to see blood, and he would slit the throats of some of his young victims. He said, the sound of blood when I cut her throat made me ejaculate. I stabbed her throat and drank the blood that gushed out. So, yeah, he even at one point, such was his incredibly depraved appetite that one time he was strolling through a Dusseldorf park and came upon a sleeping swan and cut off its head and ejaculated while drinking the blood as it pumped from the swan's neck stump. So,
yeah. Jeez. Incredible. You write about a movie that was Monsieur Verdot in 1947, directed and written by Charlie Chaplin, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
Story of Bluebeard.
Mm-hmm.
And this was inspired by just the Mother Goose tales from Charles Perrault. Tell us tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this Henry Landru.
Well, the Perrault connection is... that the classic fairy tale Bluebeard, which is about a young woman who is kind of forced into marrying this creepy aristocrat who has a blue beard, is taken to his castle. And soon afterwards, he goes on a trip and gives her the keys. He says she has free run of the castle, and these are the keys to every room, but there's one room you're not allowed to go into. And, of course, when he's gone, her curiosity gets the best of her. She enters the room, discovers, to her horror, that it's full of the dismembered body parts of all his previous wives. It's a very, very gruesome fairy tale. I mean, there are other fairy tales and folk stories of that type around the world. They're, folklorists call them bloody chamber stories or forbidden chamber stories. Anyway, in Western culture, Bluebeard is the most famous. And the term Bluebeard has come to be applied to a certain kind of serial killer, men who marry a succession of wives and then... And then murder them. I'm actually in the process of researching the case of a very infamous American Bluebeard named Johann Hoppe. So in France, Henri Landru was probably their most famous Bluebeard killer. He was actually quite a bizarre-looking guy who operated in the aftermath of the World War I, in which the young male population of Western Europe was totally decimated, leaving countless widows. Landru, again, who, in spite of his bizarre appearance, you know, obviously exerted some kind of charm, you know, married a series of women, and ended up, you know, murdering a bunch of them for their property. So that case, which got a great deal of international coverage, fascinated both Charlie Chaplin and Orson Welles. You know, the original plan was to make a kind of nonfiction movie very directly based on Landrieu. But anyway, what we ended up with was Chaplin's comedy. Monsieur Verdoux, in which, again, Chaplin plays, you know, this very, very charming gentleman who seduces and then murders a bunch of women and ends, you know, with a courtroom scene in which he, you know, he makes an impassioned speech in his own defense, in which he sort of justifies his crimes, you know, as being much less heinous than what, you know, than the world, than, you know, what the world has just lived through, in terms of the incredible, you know, incredible destruction and devastation of World War One. You know, he says, as a mass killer, I'm an amateur by comparison, you know, to what civilization has done to itself. So,
right. Now, you talk about Murder on the Orient Express, and this has been filmed three times, I believe. And it's notable not because of its accuracy and connection to an actual crime and those details, but just that this has been filmed more times, an Agatha Christie adaptation filmed the most times. What I found interesting was something far less known, is Night of the Hunter in 1955 with Shelley Winters, Robert Mitchum. And you say it's one of the most notorious mass murders in world history, yet is barely remembered today. Again, another Lonely Hearts type case. Tell us a little bit about this Night of the Hunter and its relation to the true crime that inspired it.
Okay. Well, just to go back for 1 minute, the reason I cover Murder on the Orient Express isn't because, you know, the actual plot of the Agatha Christie, famous murder mystery, you know, in which a murder has been committed on a train, and, you know, the great Belgian detective Hercule Poirot solves the crime. You know, he knows, obviously, one of the passengers must have committed it. But the connection to real life crime is that the murder victim, the backstory of the murder victim, was inspired by the very, very sensational kidnapping murder of the Charles Lindbergh son in the 1930s.
Right.
You know, which many people even now regard as the crime of the 20th century. So that's the connection there. Well, so Night of the Hunter, again, great masterpiece, directed, the only movie directed by the famous actor Charles Laughton, with a screenplay written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author James Agee, who also wrote the screenplay for African Queen, the great John Huston movie, with Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn. So, you know, it's about this really scary self-proclaimed minister played by Robert Mitchum, who has gone around murdering different women, as we learn in the beginning of the film. And then who sets his sights on the widow of a recently executed prisoner who he knows, prisoner who he shared a cell with, stole a bunch of money, which has never been recovered. And the Mitchum character knows this money is somehow with the family. So he tracks down the family, marries the widow, Shelley Winters, you know, murders her. Anyway, it's a very stylized, poetic, and terrifying movie. And again, it was based on a novel. And the direct inspiration for the novel, he was not, by any stretch of the imagination, you know, one of the most monstrous mass murderers, but that's how he was advertised in the tabloids of the time. But nevertheless, he was a guy named Harry Powers, a vacuum cleaner salesman from West Virginia, he was also a kind of bluebeard killer, although he never actually married his victims, you know, but he would put these, he would answer ads or place ads in some of these Lonely Hearts magazines and then lure widows to what was really a torture chamber he had built inside a garage in a town called Quiet Dell. And again, he was ultimately, you know, he killed, he murdered a number of women. He murdered some of their children, ultimately captured and hanged. And again, it was an extremely sensational case locally and even nationally. There were ballads and songs created about it. So that became, as I said, the inspiration for the novel Night of the Hunter, which then got transformed into this classic film, another movie that if your listeners haven't seen it, I very highly recommend.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you write, in real life, 30,000 curiosity seekers overran the murder farm and took everything they could get. You write about it in this book, some of this morbid curiosity in these huge groups of people that want to see and have a souvenir to take home.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that happens wherever there's a sensational crime. The book I wrote before this, Hell's Princess, about the Lady Bluebeard, Belle Gunness of LaPorte, Indiana. Also tens of thousands of people showed up at her murder farm after her crimes were discovered. There were, again, people selling ice cream and peddling postcards of the victims' bodies. You find that kind of phenomenon almost everywhere. I'm sure it's one of the reasons, for example, that Ed Gein's townspeople burned down his house after his atrocities were discovered, you know, because they knew it was just going to be a tourist attraction. Virtually every crime that I've written about, you have the same phenomenon. I was just writing about a mass murder that happened in Philadelphia in 1866. And after that crime was discovered, same thing, you know, on a Sunday, thousands of people, you know, they were running excursion. It was on the very outskirts of the city. So they're running special excursion trains out there. And, you know, people basically, you know, if they hadn't been stopped by the police, they would have basically taken the place apart. You know, people were just taking pieces of wood from the barn where the bodies were found and all kinds of stuff. So
it's also fascinating. You talk about a month after the arrest, a lynch mob surrounded the jailhouse, and these lawmen, heavily armed lawmen, had to protect him and had to take him to another prison hundreds of miles away. There's thousands of people storming this, and there's a couple stories in this book at the same thing, where a lynch mob overcomes. You know, in this case, the police, the lawmen protected him, but in the other case, they were successful. So fascinating response by the public in these stories to these what was by the media made a lot of headway with publication and readership with some of these cases that fascinated the public, certainly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, as I'm sure you know, lynch mobs have been an unfortunate feature of our society, you know, going back a long time. You know, there have been many cases. I mean, you see, like, in Western movies all the time, it's a reflection of historical truth. You know, lynch mobs, you know, sheriffs trying to hold off lynch mobs who are trying to break into the jail. And, you know, sometimes lynch mobs succeeded. I mean, one of the movies that I talk about called Fury, another Fritz Lang movie, you know, is based on a case in which these two kidnapped murderers you know, were caught and jailed, and, you know, a lynch mob, this is out in California, a lynch mob broke in and lynched them. So so yeah, it's not an unusual phenomenon, you know, not to mention all the horrific lynchings that were perpetrated against African Americans.
Mm-hmm. We have only touched on a few of, again, the 40 cases that you have examined in this, and all the movies that were inspired by true crimes, including Rope. Before I let you go, can we talk about Rope by Alfred Hitchcock, starring James Stewart and Hume Crone? This partners in murder, and like you say, gay lovers were gay lovers implied. But tell us about this. These, I guess, first example of what we might call thrill killers.
Well, Rope. There have been several movies inspired by this case. The one that sticks closest to the fact, is Richard Brooks's Compulsion. But they were all inspired, including Rope, by the very, very famous 1920s case of Leopold and Loeb, who were these brilliant, very wealthy, college-age guys, lived in Chicago. You know, this is one of the great, again, crimes of the century, the 20th century.
Yes.
They fancied themselves Nietzschean supermen, and to prove it to themselves and the world, they were going to commit the perfect crime. So they picked a victim, went out driving, picked a victim at random. Turned out to be a 14-year-old named Bobby Franks, who was actually a cousin. I can't remember which one. I think of Dickie Loeb. And murdered him and buried his naked body in a culvert outside the city, sent ransom notes to the family, in spite of their belief that they'd committed the perfect crime. They were captured within days. And, you know, they were sort of, it struck this very, very powerful chord in the nation at that time, partly because they were seen as the nightmarish incarnations of the culture at the time called the flaming youth, you know, this out of control, wild jazz age kids who just live for thrills. They pled guilty, so they weren't tried, but they had a long sentencing proceeding, and they were represented by the great defender Clarence Darrow. So their trial, we'll call it, you know, again, was covered nationally and internationally. Leopold and Loeb have become, you know, kind of entered into the annals of American crime as these, you know, kind of quasi-mythical characters like Lizzie Borden. Their story has been, you know, told various times. Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, which is based on a Broadway play, which was based on Leopold and Loeb, is a very interesting film. It's kind of an experimental film, which Hitchcock shot so that it looks as though it was all done in a single take, you know, kind of like the recent movie 1917, although this one basically just takes place, you know, inside a single apartment. So, you know, it's very, very interesting for that reason. And it stars, again, one of, you know, Hitchcock's favorite actors, Jimmy Stewart, as the mentor to the two young thrill killers.
Yes, absolutely. We didn't get a chance to talk about Shadow of a Doubt, Scream, A Place in the Sun, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, The Fugitive, Double Indemnity, a classic called Elephant by Gus Van Sant, and Chicago, among some others. But that's for the reader to explore. I want to thank you very much for talking about Ripped from the Headlines, the shocking true stories behind the movie's most memorable crimes. For people that might want to find out more, is there a website or obviously a Facebook page that they might take a look at for more information?
Well, I do have a Facebook page and a website, HaroldSchechter.com is the website. Tell you the truth, I'm not a Facebook person, and I do have a Facebook page which is overseen and created by a friend of mine, but it's there. So
yeah.
People know how to use Facebook, they can go on that. But HaroldSchechter.com, and, you know, the book, you know, well, now with so many stores closed, you know, probably the best place for interested buyers to get the book, either in its physical form or Kindle form, is Amazon.
Yes, absolutely. Is there? Did I see an audiobook version of this as well already?
Yes, there's also a very nice audio version.
Great, fantastic. Well, it's been a pleasure, as once again, Harold, Ripped from the Headlines, the shocking true stories behind the movie's most memorable crimes. Fantastic. Congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for
this
interview.
Well, thank
Have
you
a great
for
evening.
Having me on the show. Yep, you too.
Oh, thank you. Good night.